Okay, we're back. We're here after 2 weeks of COVID-19, COVID-18, COVID number quarantine. Back. We are the first podcast in the world to be quarantined, and now the 2 week incubation period is over, and we're back to infect the world with hope this helps. Welcome back.
We had are plenty of
loaded
time
with stuff this
to
week
find content
to make up for last week and any other week in between that might have been missed.
It's the gift that keeps
on
giving.
Microsoft wanted to provide us plenty of content as well by making everything not function. So it's gonna be a fun show.
And then Apple
outages or stuff not loading or certificates not being reloaded or anything like that.
Does not belong to him at
Apple
all.
Apple and Gmail and some guy down in North Carolina who thinks my Gmail is his, which it's not. Okay, so can we talk about this? There's a guy down in North Carolina who has a Costco account, and he sends, whenever he buys something on Costco.com and has it shipped to his house, I get the receipt email. I get the emails for all the treadmills he's buying, all the tires he's buying, and anything in between. Whatever weird stuff he's buying just goes to my inbox, and I don't know how to get this to stop. There's no button in the email that states, is this email intended for you? Were you meant to receive this email? If not, click this link, and we'll get it resolved. But no, I can't. I just get an endless stream of receipts for stuff I didn't buy. I get this guy's address and personal information and everything, and I can't stop receiving it. I don't know what to do. And if I go to the feedback page at the bottom of the email, it just goes to a 404. So I'm not sure how to resolve this or make Costco know or make this guy know that this email does not belong to him, but it's my email and you can't have it, guy.
I'm just wondering, like, did he spell his own name wrong? Was this intentional? Because he really just doesn't want his own receipts.
My theory is that he might have a similar Gmail address, but he either spelled it wrong or the place that he put it in his Costco account wasn't what he thought it was. So Gmail has a feature where and this applies to anyone with a Gmail email address, if you place dots anywhere inside your existing Gmail, so if I'm like johnsmith@gmail.com, your also accessible via john.smith@gmail.com, j.onsmith@gmail.com, or any combination of dots or placement of dots in the email address. Gmail works that way where you just kind of have a semi-infinite amount of SMTP addresses that you're addressable by. And that's to help out with like registrations on websites, or if you need multiple accounts for something, or if you need to get around some blockage where it only lets you have, I don't know, any kinds of limitations like that, Gmail helps get around to. But the downside of that is some people don't understand this, and they think that an email address is theirs when it's not. And someone has got one of my Gmail addresses and put a dot in a certain spot, and now I'm getting these emails. But I don't know how he understands that he will never be able to log into this account, because it's my account with two-factor authentication and a complex password, and I ain't giving it to him. What I wish I could do, and I might resort to this, is I might just reset his account password on Costco and maybe tell customer service, reach out to this guy, please, and tell him that he needs to update his email address to an email he owns and one that isn't mine.
You sound very angry about this.
I am, mostly because whenever you buy something on Costco, you get 2 to 3 emails with status updates, and if you cancel it or change it or anything like that, I just know everything about this guy's orders, and I just don't want to know about them anymore.
Understandable.
I kind of want to do the ethical thing where, you know, I can get it fixed for him, but I don't know how else to tell him. I think a couple of years ago, someone else had the same problem, but I was able to actually reach out to the guy and tell him, hey, this is my email, not yours. And he was like, oh, I didn't know, thanks. But this guy, I don't know what to do.
Yeah, this one just sounds very... I'm just still trying to understand how he got his own email address wrong.
I don't know. Maybe he's old. I didn't bother to look up how old he was or any other info, which I probably could, because, you know, his address just gets sent to me.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Randomly. So, but I'm going to be the white hat and just not go down that road.
That's fair.
I'll just, yeah.
You it's a hard don't life. Need to know.
Yeah. So anyway, that's my hot sizzler opening of a complaint for the week that I've been living through. I don't know if you've been experiencing anything else like that, Tiff, but
no, I've never gotten emails as someone else. I can't say that's happened to me.
You think that would happen considering how much you work with Exchange and emails and SMTPs and all that?
Yeah, luckily I don't really have to deal with that. I have a pretty not normal name. You have typical name.
I unfortunately have I tend to have a common name, and it's more common than I realize, especially with email addresses. Yeah. So I should stop having email addresses be my name, even though it's nice on a resume or to send to someone.
Yeah, no, definitely.
Anyways, in completely other unrelated news, Philips Hue's, they're not great for security.
No.
To say the least.
Tell us more.
In the department of probably old at this point, and I think there's a patch out at this point, there's a new bulletin put out by NIST that Philips Hue's are very breachable, and they can be exploited via a buffer overflow via the Zigbee protocol that it utilizes, that particularly the bridge utilizes, and it can effectively allow a not authorized bad actor to come into your network and turn your lights on and off. So beware.
That's just a really funny thing. Hold on, I'm just gonna flicker someone's lights just to drive them insane. That would be the best prank to play on somebody.
It is an unbelievably strange thing to have to explain to someone that this is a critical security vulnerability in your network because your lights might go on and off.
I would personally just do it to drive someone insane.
Yeah, and it's a tough sell to convince someone that it's actually a major problem, because when you're explaining this to them, they just think that you're just a crazy person. But in actuality, you know, you think of the other information that can be gathered via this exploit, and then suddenly the situation gets a whole lot worse. So Philips already released a patch to resolve this. So assuming people actually hear about this enough and regularly update their Hue bridges, then it shouldn't be a problem. And if you just buy those like Costco bulbs or non-bridgeable bulbs that just use like Bluetooth or direct connections, then you're apparently safe from this particular flaw. So
see, I just use dumb light bulbs.
Yeah, I have a couple of Hue bulbs. I do admit that they are nice, and I probably should isolate my bridge a little more than I do, but aside from that, yeah, analog bulbs. You know, the light switch can't usually be hacked through conventional means unless someone walks up and flips it on and off or rewires it in your walls. But it's really hard to fit inside a wall without being noticed.
But just imagine that if all of a sudden your light started flickering. I would just think it was the poltergeist.
Or the wind outside. The wind is hacking my house.
The wind. It's the wind.
All kinds of manners of things. So
yeah, no, definitely. I would say update your Philips Hues and don't flicker someone's lights.
Yeah, and live long and prosper with strangely colored bulbs throughout your house with security.
Yay.
Yeah, that's all I have to say about that. So Microsoft, remember when we were complaining about the Chrome extension along with half of the internet? And so Microsoft has officially backed off on their threat to take over every browser on the planet, and they have basically listened to the feedback and very graciously put out a PR press release effectively stating, "We're sorry that you're not excited about this feature. We're incredibly sorry that you do not want Bing everywhere or the second binging to occur." If you have Windows 10,
the second binging.
So, man, are we just completely and utterly bummed that you are not excited about Bing? So, we will very graciously not roll Bing out to browsers that don't belong to us. We will not invade all these other pieces of software that we don't own, and quite frankly, we did not vet, or they did not vet us coming in. So that's the end of that. No Bing for you, and we're sorry you're not happy.
Yeah.
Thanks for all the feedback.
So long, and thanks for all the fish.
Yep. The Microsoft Search and Bing browser extension will not automatically be deployed with Office 365 Pro Plus. You can toggle it if you wish. If you really want it, oh, we'll give you it. But I guess it will be optional now, as opposed to everyone just experiencing the wonderful Bing like Christmas morning one day when they come to their computers and open their login sessions like presents under a tree.
Yeah. I don't know if I'd call it a present. More like a cancer.
Yeah. Redmond's definition of present and cancer might be synonymous with each other.
Did I ever tell you the time that I got into a Twitter fight with Tony Redmond?
Oh yeah. Boy, let's no, you did not. Let's hear about this.
Like a
oh
while
my god.
Ago, not too long ago.
Oh nice.
And I had disagreed with something that he had mentioned about Exchange, and we got into like a little it was like a 4 or 5 comment long Twitter battle.
Ooh, 5 comments. You know, it gets really serious when you get a little past 3. When you get to 5, then it's a fight.
When you get Tony Redmond to comment. Whoops. Not probably the person I wanted to pick a battle with on the internet.
Was he being like really sarcastic or was he actually getting into it? Were there hashtags involved?
No, he did not hashtag it. But he was pretty like disagreeing with my stance on it.
What was it about?
It was something Exchange related. I quickly aborted the conversation when I realized quickly that it was Tony Redmond.
Oh no.
Like, this is not a topic I will ever win.
He's going to invoke, you know, Steve Ballmer or whoever.
And write more books about it.
I forget. Did you meet him at one of the Ignite parties?
No, I have not. Oh, not okay. Not Tony. Then,
see, that would have been a conversation starter if you met him in person. Be like, hey, we argued on Twitter once about Exchange, about that one thing.
Yeah, that one time. It was really insignificant, but we did.
Oh, jeez.
Oh, wow. This is also interesting news. So you can post your post Yammer through OWA.
Ooh, I can Yammer my OWA?
You can Yammer your OWA.
Finally, yeah. Through all these years, I've always wanted to Yammer through OWA. And OWA my Yammers.
But do people honestly use Yammer? Is that a thing?
I think I accidentally logged into it once, maybe in 2012. That's really the last time I think I've ever used Yammer.
I know, like, there's this big hoopla about Yammer coming back, but honestly, I still have heard nothing about its resurrection.
I was told so much about the year of Yammer at Ignite, and this is definitely not the year of Yammer, let me tell you that.
Yeah.
I have not moved to Yammer, I have not posted to Yammer, and I've quite frankly not wanted to use Yammer.
No, I have found no real need.
So I'd like to be enlightened on what this year of Yammer is and when it's going to come and when it's really going to hit me hard in the face.
Something that is exciting, though, that is not Yammer is the ability to post multi-channel in Teams. Yeah.
Whoa. I can spam multiple channels in Teams now?
You can spam multiple channels.
Oh boy, more than one notification to dismiss at once.
And
I love it. Tell me more.
And you can message up to 50 channels. And Ooh. Then you can add replies to the original post. So you could spam your entire organization if you felt like it.
I am loving this. I can spam and fish people in Teams now. What a wonderful feature from Microsoft that has been bestowed upon us.
And that is being rolled out now.
Awesome. How can I do that in Teams? Is there a big menu? Do they give a big button that I can just say message
it's
everybody?
It's just a spearfish.
That is wonderful. You know what I'm really starting to wonder now is can you like do just what phishing emails do, but just in Teams, where you can just give a malicious link and have it sent out to everyone, and you can at people and tell them, hey, you need to click this now.
Yeah, and now that too, I saw a preview of OWA in Teams. Not OWA.
Oh, really?
Sorry,
I don't
Outlook.
Have to like. Oh, well, still, regardless. No, that's my ooh still applies because in Teams, I did do the hack where you can add a tab to a channel and you can add a website and make it OWA. I guess now it's official. They just want you to use email in your Teams.
I had always thought that was going to happen.
Yeah, same. It seemed like it was really built and geared towards eventually making it a one-stop shop, a one-window experience for messaging and a next generation kind of thing.
They definitely want it to be the one app to rule them all.
Yeah, I'm kind of okay with it, to be honest. I know plenty of people who aren't okay with it, but hey, it is what it is.
I really like Teams.
Yeah, it's as for as much crap as I do give it occasionally, I still really like it. It's so much worlds better than Skype, and the integrations in it are sensible and they make sense. It just has to catch. It has to catch up to other chat apps like Slack.
Yeah, it's still very buggy because I think they try to throw so much at it at one time.
Yeah, and I have, I don't know about you, but I have the problem where I work in EDU and we're behind on the updates for Teams. So every feature that they announce, we maybe get like a year plus later. Like a long time ago, they announced that they were going to roll the Teams notifications into the Windows 10 Notification Center. That update still hasn't come out for EDU, which drives me insane.
Yeah, no, that's no good.
And it's really annoying because the built-in native Teams notifications pop over everything, and they do not respect your settings in Windows 10 for quiet hours or priority notifications. So if you're in a meeting, I basically have to quit Teams. Otherwise, I have to mute channels or mute people, and then it gets you have, you know, so many awkward moments where you have messages showing up while you're projecting that you don't want them to see, or confidential information, PII, all kinds of really odd situations that you don't want
to occurring. Then you're in spam town.
Yeah, and then everyone's messaging you or liking or reacting.
Right, and then you might as well just send a message out to all of your channels.
Mm-hmm, indeed. So I really hope Microsoft can at least remedy the situation where the update scheduling can be unified between non-EDU and EDU, or E5 or E3 or whatever 0365 tenant plan you are this week,
right,
kind of thing.
That'll be nice. Someday.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Someday. All right. So I think that's all I have for Teams and just Office 365, because I just honestly feel like there's been so much thrown at the world for Office 365 in the past month or two that it's so...
Absolutely.
It's not really digestible anymore.
Yeah. And that includes not only the new features and changes that come out, but it's also the outages and the issues that are happening. Because, oh my goodness, in the past 2 weeks, have we had some problems? Was it the past 2 weeks when Teams didn't work because of the renewed certificate on Microsoft's end didn't work?
Yeah, that is correct.
That was lovely. Ironically, I don't think I experienced it either. I think you only experienced it if you signed out of Teams and I think when it expired, I was during the day when I was already signed in. So I doubt that I actually got to see it, but apparently half the world did because it reached so many tech sites and tech news. And
right. It really did take out a bunch.
Yeah, absolutely. And then the admin portal went down 2 or 3 days ago.
Yep. I did not experience that, fortunately, but I have heard.
Yeah, I was seeing reports it was down in the northeast, northwest, at the review of the Reddit thread, but it was funny. The official status page reported no issues, but as we know, the status page is behind everything else.
Right. And soon, hopefully, the report and outage button will be coming out.
Yeah, and we won't have to use down detector or r/sysadmin or any of the non-conventional, non-official ways, or there can be an official channel in Microsoft Office 365 to complain about outages and have comment threads and the like. Unless that, of course, that goes down.
Let's hope it doesn't. All right. So hopefully nothing more breaks. And then there is also the Windows 10 search bar.
Oh, this was something that did affect me. Yeah, so Windows 10 search in the past, last week, if you tried to search anything in Windows, local or online, you just got a big blank screen. We were playing with it around the office, and I think we determined that if you had Windows 10 1903, and if you had Windows 10 1903, I think it just straight up did not work at all. And if you had dark mode enabled on older editions of Windows 10, it somehow didn't work either.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a really strange spread, but there was a really consistent fix where you could set the registry to effectively disable Bing integration in the start menu search, and you could either reboot or you could restart a particular service to repair the search feature.
Awesome.
So that happened. Microsoft hasn't quite fessed up correctly as to what really happened. They claimed it was a fiber provider issue, but come on, honestly.
Right. That like, doesn't make sense.
It doesn't make sense because during that time, I was trying Bing searches in a browser, and they were working. So if it's querying the same servers like that, what's really going on here?
Well, and I still have a jump box that the search doesn't work on.
Oh, really? Even even now? So they still haven't fully fixed it?
Mm-mm.
Oh, yikes. That's not great.
Yeah. So my actual computer works fine, but my jump box does not.
Yeah. I just looked it up. The command to restart the service that will get Bing search working without a reboot is tskill search UI. So it's the search the search UI process is the one to basically kick if that happens. It was a nice advertisement for advertising everything search by Void Tools. That was nice. I was like, you know, that never breaks. It's just local search, no Bing, no online, no anything. Just works for me.
Yeah, I just miss not having anything connected to the world. Offline, I was just thinking about it the other day. I was like, I miss the days of just having a local copy of Office.
Yeah, same. I just like boxed local software, honestly. Call me old-fashioned, but that stuff usually works in the event of, you know, a server change or some strange internet-based event out of my control.
Right, let me just clack my little key in and then call it a day.
Yeah. I could get into a whole other discussion about that with, you know, gaming software or whatever, but, you know, it's the same feeling regardless, digital versus having a local copy that right. you own. It has its benefits, especially when you have something as not so reliable as Office 365.
Mm-hmm.
Which agreed. At this point we might call it Office 363 or something.
Right.
We're still early in the year. We're not at like Office 337 yet.
It could be like Office, yeah. It's probably close to like Office 363. That makes about right.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
I wonder if someone has calculated all the downtime Office 365 has actually incurred in like the year 2019, and then you just take it and just lop off a couple of numbers off of 365, and that's the new service name. Just Office $ number. That should be the service name.
Agreed.
Welcome to the cloud. Reliable.
We have uptime of 362 days.
Okay, so we've gone through all the outages I can think of, unless there's been any more that you have that I haven't remembered.
No,
or
I think we talk about them on the daily.
All right, that's our biweekly our hopefully not biweekly but biweekly catch up of outages and Microsoft things.
Do you want to go on your Apple rant?
We could go.
I'm excited to hear this.
Okay, let's do the Apple rant. Let's do that.
Because you never post on Twitter, and so when you do, it must be important.
Yes. So my Apple rant, it was one of those feelings that I got where, you know, I've had this sentiment about Apple for a while, but it would kind of manifested itself the other night when we were walking into an Apple store. And okay, so it's been about a year since I've switched over from a MacBook to a Surface as my main portable machine. And long story short, it's kind of changed the way I use a laptop. I am more accustomed to using a touchscreen on demand or as needed when it's a more convenient form of input, but without sacrificing the traditional means of mouse and keyboard. If I need to scroll or poke something or whatever, you know, it can be something stupid, but it's nice to have that touchscreen option. So I walked into an Apple store the other night, and Apple makes a very prominent display of iPhones, iPads, iPads with keyboards, iPad Pros, Apple Watches. All of these things have touchscreens. The things that don't have touchscreens are also displayed, you know, kind of next to them. Big things like iMacs with the glossy glass screens, MacBook Pros with glossy black screens, and all kinds of sizes and form factors and things like that. So if you are looking at these randomly or you're darting around the store, you might encounter what I encountered, where you are just playing with a MacBook and there's a UI element that kind of looks like a touch responsive button that's big, bright, and blue and rectangular, you might want to reach out to touch it on the screen. So I'm doing that with the, on the MacBook in the store, and I had to remind myself, no, stupid, this is not a touchscreen, because Apple, for some reason, does not want to put touchscreens in MacBooks. Why? Couldn't tell me. I can use the iPad right next to it with a keyboard attached to it. The only thing that's missing is the trackpad. You can even plug in a mouse and enable the accessibility mouse feature to make it almost like a laptop and behave almost identically like a laptop, but you can't. So this brings me to my core thesis and my core question of tonight's topic of, if Steve could reinvent Apple, what would I change? What would I basically make not redundant? And what would I unify about the company? So needless to say, I think one of the first things I would do is I would put touchscreens on MacBooks, and I would either deprecate or retire the iPad line, taking its very best features and integrating it with the MacBook and making it one unified product. It is currently fairly close, I'd say, to having both almost mix with each other, considering Apple is working with Project Catalyst and Catalina and making the apps with universal purchases among all the app stores. They are almost there. It's just the final link between the two finally needs to be created. What I would probably do is I would combine the iOS and the macOS hardware and software and utilize what is existing Catalyst paradigms and just make it work for this hardware.
Well, you can, considering that OS X, I refuse to call it OS 10, is the platform that both the Mac software and the iPad software are built off of, they just need to make the iOS software actually usable for real life.
Yeah, I also agree about that, because with iOS, you have just kind of general growing pains with interfaces, and the single window interface of iOS is difficult to make a pro product out of. And it's unlike the Mac, which can have you can have right clicks, you can have integrations with other apps much easier and more freedom overall. With iOS, there's a ceiling to that. And there's been a lot of discussion lately with the iPad Pro and iOS 13, iPad OS 13, where you have people questioning the multitasking interface, where it's too complicated for regular users to understand, and the pro users just want more out of it, but it's just inadequate. So it's satisfying nobody, honestly. So it's one of those things where it really needs to be rethought. And I think John Gruber of Daring Fireball has put out a postmortem of Apple from 2019, and he graded iOS and iPad OS and kind of laid out a roadmap for what he would do as for improvements. And iOS 13 is one of the top things he was speaking of.
Oh, wow. That's really exciting.
I don't usually agree with him often, but in this case, I really do like what he's saying about that. It's something that I understand what Apple wants to do, but it's not connecting, and they really need to rectify that.
I agree. It's been ununified for a long time.
Yeah. It's one of those things where it's designed almost in a tube that doesn't reflect real world. And then they come out and say, this is the real world and you will like it. But it's not how the real world functions. And because for a long time, I mean, I'm sure you have a similar story, where I used to really enjoyed Apple products a lot in like the early 2010s.
Yeah.
I thought they were particularly well made up to a certain point. I thought really macOS Snow Leopard was really well done. This was
the
way before
the best one.
Yep, this was before the iPad. This was before a lot of the interface changes came along. It was just a really good desktop operating system. It was fast, things were really well built, and you had a momentum going. But when they started to make it more like the iPad and bring in the iPad's features to a desktop OS, that's when things started to kind of go downhill, because those features would work if you gave the Mac a touchscreen. But if you don't, it's really awkward using non-touch interfaces with a non-touchscreen hardware. Or sorry, non-touch interfaces with a touch-based UI.
100% agree.
And ever since then, it's kind of been a comic mismatch of these two hardware and software systems not quite wanting to play ball with each other because of corporate pride or some kind of executive at Apple who just didn't want them to merge. And it's been like that ever since. Meanwhile, I think it's taken a very long time to get there, but the Microsoft Surface has actually gotten to a point where I really do like
its interoperability
and the fact that it can switch between a laptop, a tablet, or somewhere in between.
And it's really good at it.
Yeah, seriously.
It does its job right.
Yeah, because I know like the first four generations of the Surface were not, they had bugs, they had issues. The software had a lot of growing pains. Windows 8, Windows 8.1. But now I feel like when we got into 10, things have calmed down. And now with what I believe is macOS's kind of depreciation over time in terms of quality, mm-hmm. software quality, and not really knowing what it wants to do with the overall direction, Windows 10 is kind of polishing the tablet interface and making the hybrid tablet and mobile computer experience just feel complete to me.
Right. And too, with Microsoft finally announcing the death of 1809.
Yeah.
Finally.
Yeah, it's well, I wouldn't say a long time coming, but finally I'm just happy. I mean, call me old. I'm still kind of brushing off the scars of Windows 10 1607. I just remember that was...
Ouch. Yeah, that was a long time ago.
That was one of the worst Windows 10 builds, to be honest. That thing was... Like, Windows Update didn't work. Drivers didn't work. Random features didn't work. We've come a long way since then.
Well, 1809 was pretty painful.
Yeah, 1809, I think, at the start was pretty bad. Wasn't that the one that would delete your profile if you did an in-place upgrade?
Yeah.
Yeah, so... You know, a couple things still exist, and I'm not saying that Windows 10 isn't perfect, but, you know, I can say it's probably doing a little bit better than macOS at this point. Currently, Catalina's been slammed for having a lot of bugs and being crashy and being a lot like Windows Vista, strangely enough. Catalina has this thing where it now kind of asks for permission to do anything, which is really counterintuitive to a user. Mm. It was what Apple released ads about knocking Vista for back in 2006-2007.
Ouch. I just miss the cats.
Yeah, I miss the cats as well. Funny enough, I have a kitty right at my desk.
Lasagna,
the tuxedo cat. When you release macOS Tuxedo Cat, let me know. And that's when it will be.
Yes.
It'll be released alongside the MacBook Touch, and it will be perfect.
I would buy that so hard.
I would too. It's one of those things, Apple, it's like, it doesn't take much to bring me back. Just make a MacBook with a touch screen. Not a touch bar, a touch screen.
Yeah, that was honestly the stupidest thing ever.
I seriously saw like one of the dumbest things about the touch bar last night at the Apple store also, where I saw it was like a Tamagotchi simulator. It was called Touch Bar Pet.
Wait, what? And
yeah, this is a real piece of software written by a real human, I assume. Mm. It's basically, it turns your touch bar into this little Tamagotchi-like pet, and you watch it eat things. And then on the main screen, there's just a big black rectangle, and I think it just tells you to look at the touch bar.
Really?
And I'm like, wow, I'm so glad I paid $2,000 for this computer that has this wonderful little not touchscreen thing that replaced all my function keys.
I mean, I kind of am excited about the idea of like a Tamagotchi touchscreen pet. But at the same time, I would just want it to be clippy.
Yeah. And honestly, it's like when I'm looking at a laptop with a touchscreen, I'm like, you know what the touch bar is? The whole screen. You can just have that on the screen. Why waste all this like computer, this keyboard space for function keys for something that's just like, I don't know.
Or keyboard shortcuts. Just make it a keyboard shortcut and call it a day.
Yeah.
I don't need the little pictures to tell me what to click.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe that's an unpopular opinion.
I have a lot of unpopular opinions, and at this point, I just kind of don't care, as you can clearly see.
I just don't care anymore.
That's why it's called Hope This Helps. We don't know if it's helpful, and
it's probably not at all helpful.
My opinions are mostly null and void. So.
Hmm.
Anyways, so yeah, that's my core ideas about Apple's touch ambitions. Other things, they're just like little complaints, like get away from bad subscription models. Why is there Apple News Plus? Why is there Apple Music Plus? Why is there Apple Videos Plus or whatever Plus? Just make it one.
They have Plus versions now?
Well, there's Apple News Plus, which is the thing that literally no one buys because that's been a problem. And I'm not quite sure I understand what it is, to be totally honest. It's like, you know, the Apple News app. Well, if you subscribe, you can get more news, which is not something I'm sure I want exactly.
So even more news.
Yeah. Don't you love that?
Wow.
And then there's, you know, there's Apple Music Plus or whatever, but my point here is they're all separate subscriptions. There's not one rolled up subscription you can get. And instead, I just have, you know, a million different charges to my card every month, and it's just kind of overwhelming. It's the whole subscription fatigue thing.
Yeah, they should let you, like, roll them all in. So, like, a la carte style.
Yeah. I'm not a fan of subscription products in general, and I don't like how everything, you know, you just have to get your wallet just destroyed every month just to use anything these days.
It's really hard to keep track.
Yeah, Apple used to be the champion of just not having this stuff, and unfortunately now they're just another company that does this.
Well, they have a credit card now.
Yeah, woohoo. Remember that?
It's metal.
It's metal, and it's run by a third-party bank that,
right,
you know, not so private after a while.
Right, right. Definitely Apple has lost its glitz and glamour.
And then I have other notes, like, I would make iCloud actually a top-tier cloud provider instead of the toy that it currently is, quite frankly.
Me was so good.
Mobile Me, Mac.com, iTools, I think, was the original
iteration. Yeah, it was so good.
Iteration.
Mobile Me was before its time.
I have a Me.com address because that was right when, I think that was when I first made my Apple account. So I do have an SMTP of Me.com. It's really nice to type into things because it's nice and short.
Yes. Mobile Me was so good. It was totally not worth the subscription price, but it was pretty good.
Yeah. I never used it. I remember clicking it by accident, but sure it was great at the time.
Because Apple started the cloud documents, the cloud storage, because they had iCloud, iDrive, I think it was.
Oh, geez. Yeah, I know what you're talking about. iDisk, that's what it was.
iDisk. So you had cloud storage, and that was before cloud storage was a thing.
Right, it was kind of the very early iteration of Dropbox, right before Dropbox hit the scene. Wasn't it all free back then, too?
So it was a subscription, but now that I think of it, it was like $99. But it covered all of this stuff.
Oh, but so it's kind of like what my complaint was, where it's like it's a one subscription, you know, one purchase or whatever. It's a single unified bundle. And you just have to worry about that one thing and not a thousand little things.
Exactly.
So look at that. Apple even used to do some of the stuff that I'd really wish that they would go back to. So, yeah. Okay.
They had it all figured out before anybody else did.
Yeah. So I would say Apple just looked to the past for some solutions to some of these growing pains, I guess. So lastly, other than that, I don't know. It's going back to go back to make hardware that isn't flavor of the week or artsy stuff.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
HomePod still confuses me to this day. It's a very odd phenomenon that I don't understand.
Yeah, I don't even know. I'm so far behind on my Apple stuff.
From what I've heard, the HomePod is, it's, you know, if you can imagine Siri and how Siri currently doesn't really do a lot of things for you, but if you imagine a big cylinder in your house that will equally not listen to you or understand what you're saying, and you got an extra $400 to spare, buy a HomePod.
Sounds like my 5-year-old, and I don't even need to buy a HomePod.
Oh my god, it's like a 5-year-old. Yeah. If you want to buy a 5-year-old, you have to plug into the wall, and you ask it to do things for you, and it won't. There
sounds,
you go.
Sounds about right.
You don't even get to name it. It comes with a name.
It comes with a name.
It's a name you can't change, Siri.
It's a very Scandinavian name.
It is.
Which I didn't realize because I had a friend in high school named Siri or middle school named Siri, and I just thought it was a really unique name.
Until Apple came along.
Right, until I grew up and became an adult, and then I was like, oh wait, this is a very popular name.
Especially after 2010, I think.
Yes. Although the Siri I know has two eyes instead of one.
Siri does have two eyes.
Does it?
Yeah, S-I-R-I.
No, she's S-I-I-R-I.
Oh, so three eyes.
Yeah, well, total three eyes.
Oh, there you go.
Two concurrent eyes.
So,
yeah. In case it matters.
Yeah, that totally matters. This all matters.
Hope this helps. We're providing you with everyday life news.
Okay, I think I've probably run this topic into the ground.
Yes. We know you don't like Apple anymore.
Yeah, I just had to get it off my chest. It was funny, just like one little thing that sets you off, so I had to get that off my chest. And
how do you feel?
I feel better. I really genuinely feel better.
Oh, good. I'm glad that we could use this as a therapy session for you.
Yep. I'm very happy that the Hope This Helps podcast has helped me out this week.
More than you will ever know. Yep. So, anyways, Steve does PowerShell.
Wow. Am I just running all the topics this week?
You just have a lot to say.
Yeah, I guess so. It's 2 weeks. Two weeks will do that to you.
You're very emotional this week.
Yeah, so, okay. So this one is...
I'm not against it.
Yeah, this one's less about emotions and more about objective tutorializing of things that will actually might make you better as a sysadmin or an IT person. So this week in our continuing series in PowerShell goodliness, we are going to discuss error handling and null checks. Tiff, I know you were asking me about this a couple of weeks ago too.
I was.
A couple automated scripts that you could use to either skip over iterations that did not need processing or report if something wasn't going to necessarily work or whatever.
Yep, I did do that.
So my primary method of looking for bad data or running into error scenarios in PowerShell is a null check if a try catch is not something that is viable in a script. You might encounter this especially with Exchange Online commandlets where, and not even Exchange Online, just Exchange in general commandlets where things like get mailbox and get recipient will not react to a try catch block if you are not directly using the PowerShell Exchange Management shell on the box itself, which I'm quite sure not a lot of people will, especially if you're in an environment where you can't just RDP into a server and run stuff directly on servers. So when it comes to the case of PS sessions and remoting into other servers and you don't get the necessary triggers to do proper error handling, you need to use what is called null checks. And simple little trick, it works across all kinds of programming languages, but in PowerShell it is none the different, where you do simple if checks on actions or whatever, and you could say if this action or this variable that you are dumping data into retrieves null, then you can raise an error event or provide code that will handle that lack of data or lack of action that you are expecting. So that's an excellent little trick. So for example, one I like to use in a lot of my scripts for particularly AD is a situation where if you do get AD user just with the identity parameter, which is usually get AD user on the name or the SAM account name attribute, you can get a username back if it is a valid input, but say it is not a valid input. Well, if you do it with the identity parameter, you will get a traditional PowerShell error saying, hey, we couldn't find this user. You can then perform error action stop or error action ignore, error action statically continue, or you can try catch it. It will all react to that appropriately. Now, compare this to get AD user with the filter switch, where if you're saying get AD user filter user principal name equals somebody at mycompany.com, you can either have two situations where you have get AD user return one or more users, or you will have a situation where it returns no users, but never will this command typically error out for this situation. That's a situation where you can't try catch it, where the try catch will never trigger, and you won't have the error handling code fire off for get edit user filter. What you need to do instead is assign that whole command to a variable. So I call it like AD info. AD info equals get edit user filter, user principal name equals somebody at mydumbcompany.com. What you can then do is then do an if statement saying if this variable AD info is null, or if bang AD info, which is shorthand for if the AD info variable is null, do something about it. And you can then provide the same type of code block that you would in a try catch. And that helps get around the issue of commandlets either don't react to try catch or will not provide data to trigger the try catch. And so in conclusion, that's a nice little way of helping your scripts along, or if you're stuck somewhere and you need to make a script behave a certain way, then this is how you do it.
It really works.
It does. I use it myself all the time.
It's a pretty good way to do this, I have to say. Again, Steve helps me all the time with all of my PowerShell needs.
I try to, and I'm increasingly helping coworkers too. I've had one where actually I tend to have to go back to looking up documentation myself for things like comparing objects or doing for eaches inside of for eaches. It's a lot of things I have muscle memory to, but then when you go to teach someone, you're like, oh, and then I need to
look up some
docs.microsoft.com articles.
It's so funny too how it between orgs it changes, because then you have to modify certain things to make your PowerShell scripts that worked in one place work somewhere else.
Yes, and sometimes even the version of Exchange can matter too. If you're using with Exchange commandlets, like I found recently when jumping from Exchange 2010 to 2016, a lot of commandlets like new mailbox or something, new mailbox, the parameters and the command sets changed ever so slightly between the versions to be more respondent to Office 365 that weren't necessarily in Exchange 2010.
Right.
So you got to be on your toes about what changes, and you always got to read the documentation and stuff, because even I get tripped up by this.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It'll be tricky. Even with the new Exchange commandlets, they're supposed to be more efficient and more effective as far as how they work. But I listened to like 3 or 4 web series, and I'm still like, I need to listen to more because they do so much now.
Have you used the new commandlets?
I have. I like them a lot.
I've really been meaning to try them out, but I've just not had a use case for them yet somehow.
Really? I honestly, they solve the issue with the implicit remoting.
Oh, really?
Yes. There's more ways to get around that and to change how you get throttled.
I was about to ask if they changed the throttling situation. I had to explain to a coworker just this week on why I wrote a couple of scripts to be so strange and how they return data, and I had to explain the whole throttling mechanism to him, and it blew his mind. He had no idea that was a thing.
Right, because each time you connect, it makes a new connection. So
exactly.
Yeah, it takes people a little bit to wrap their head around how Office 365 connects and why it connects that way, because it makes sense. I mean, you don't own those data centers. So if you leave wide open a remote session, then you're going to slow things down for everybody.
Yeah. And it's like you said, it's really difficult to explain that to someone who's also just learning PowerShell as well. So yeah. when you're teaching someone this, they just, unfortunately,
like, what? I can't leave this open all day.
There's a lot of times I just get looks from people. It's like, why is it like this? And I'm like, because Microsoft. I'm sorry. It's just because Microsoft.
This is just how it is. It is what it is. Deal with it.
Like, for example, I don't have Microsoft Graph set up for this, so I have this hokey script that will check for duplicate and uncoupled mailboxes between on-premise Exchange and Exchange Online. So on-premise, I know the response time is going to be much faster and much more instantaneous, so I can do a full get recipient and dump to a CSV file. But in Exchange Online, I don't have the liberty of that, right, you know, that flexibility. And we have a lot of users in our org. So if I did a get recipient unlimited in the cloud, this command would either never complete or would just blow itself out with the throttling. So what I have to do is I have to do a filtered command in the cloud, and I have to know exactly what I'm looking for to compare it with the on-premise data, which is the full copy. And then I have a, it's still not ideal in any sense, and it's probably not scalable much longer, but unless we get Microsoft Graph, there's not much I can do about it. But then I can do a compare object on it with the two CSVs. One is large, but is quickly retrievable because it's on-premise data, versus the cloud data, which then I have to sift and sort before I dump the CSV.
I think with the new Exchange commandlets, there may be ways to around this so that way you can get your data without getting throttled every time.
Yeah, and that's my hope too. I'm sure Microsoft, they've been working on this for a long time.
They have addressed that. I just don't remember exactly how they did. There's multiple ways to get around it.
The REST API is the future.
Yes.
Effectively.
Yeah, I have not played around with Graph too much. I really need to get on that.
Yeah, I'm supposedly going to be playing with Microsoft Flow very soon. I don't know if you have.
Oh, nice. I have a little bit. They just changed the name, didn't they?
Yeah, I think it's called Power Automate now.
Yeah, I have a little bit. Not too much, but...
Yeah, so one of my... I call it a side hustle, but it's part of my main job. But it's a side hustle is where I have to build this email. And it's very laborious, very manual right now. And supposedly, we've been researching with Power Automate or Flow that you can get this email generated on the fly where you, the email that's providing me the data can get funneled up to Flow/Power Automate. It will sift through it. It will find keywords and build the queries it needs. And then it will drop an email into my drafts folder containing the summary email I need to send to necessary parties. So I haven't played around with it too much yet. It sounds promising. Weirdly enough, it just sounds like shortcuts in iOS or a weird GUI version of PowerShell.
Yeah.
And it's, I guess that's where it's going. Weirdly enough, I think Microsoft actually removed the ability to query for Office 365 endpoint deltas.
Oh, really?
Through PowerShell, and they've actually taken that API away and they've put it into Microsoft Power Automate now, because I had a daily monthly script that would check for it, but it stopped working recently because the API is just gone now if you try to query for it.
Oh, wow.
Or they locked it up or, you know, made it inaccessible. Mm-hmm. Oddly enough, their documentation page for it still exists, but the code that they provide doesn't seem to work anymore.
Oh, wow. That's
really
sad.
Weird.
Hmm.
Yeah, so I don't quite understand where they're going with that. I hope it's not trying to undercut PowerShell or undermine PowerShell, but I think they're trying to make it more business-oriented or make it so the non-scripting mind can wrap their heads around automation, which makes sense because that's kind of Microsoft's core AI and automation-esque focus right now.
Yes. So they want to make it as easy as possible.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, that ended up being a pretty good topic.
Not bad.
Not too shabby.
I think we're salvaging this episode just a little bit.
By accident.
totally
Look
by
at
accident.
That. It was totally not even on purpose this time. But yeah, I think that's a wrap. So you had a really good question here. Things you do when your coworker's computer is unlocked.
Oh yeah, this is the eternal question. Things you can do to torment your coworkers who do not practice good endpoint security, who do not lock their computers.
I don't know, the Hasselhoff is by far my favorite.
Yeah, so let us explain what the hoffing is. So if you
not
have...
huffing.
So I hope this helps. We like to practice education and
safe security.
We don't necessarily like to screw with your stuff. If we see in an office a computer that is unlocked and the person is not within an acceptable proximity of the machine, they're not like three cubes down or in the room, we can't see them, and their computer's wide open, you just kind of mosey on over to that wide open machine, fire up your Microsoft Edge Chromium Edition, go into Bing and search David Hasselhoff. Go to the images section. Maximize the window or press F11 to full screen it, and then press the Windows L key combination. The next time they unlock their computer, they're going to see some David Hasselhoff. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is how to hoff somebody.
I think my favorite time of hoffing somebody was when a coworker left their desktop wide open and we knew that they were going into a meeting. So we huff them so good, and then we put their application back open. No, we lock their machine after we huff them, and then they went into a meeting, and they plugged it in, and they had a giant picture of David Hasselhoff, and all of a sudden, we just heard the laughing from the meeting room.
That was wonderful.
That was the most joyous time I've ever experienced.
At the time, we were still working at the same company at the time, and that was just absolutely wonderful when that occurred. That was a joyous moment that brought so many smiles to so many people's faces.
Yes, just like our entire office just started cracking up because they all knew what we had done.
I was so happy at that. And that same coworker, I also recall, he not only left his computer unlocked, but he left his iPhone unlocked.
Yes, that was the same time.
And I literally don't know how this happens, because usually most iPhones lock after like 2 minutes or 60 seconds of an activity, but he like changed his to lock after 5 minutes. So I'm just sitting there, I'm like, you left your iPhone unlocked, man. So what do? I think I did the first hoffing of an iPhone.
This person had the most hoffs out of anybody.
Yeah, I think you also have to have a hoff count. You need to have an Excel spreadsheet with, yes, a hoff count. Host it in Office 365, and you configure change tracking notifications on the document in Office 365 to email you anytime that the document's been changed. That way you know when someone's been hoffed.
Yes. Yes. You got to get company-wide hoffing going.
Yeah. And I'm just teaching people all these features in SharePoint, like when documents get changed, you can send out email notifications.
Heck yeah.
Oh, it's wonderful.
And once you get like Teams really going, oh, it'll be so good. So good. Anyways, so that's all we have this week. So we will post that on the Twitter sphere as our question, and we will probably be the only ones to answer our own question, but that is okay.
That's totally fine. Oh, side note, when I went to the Apple Store last night, I actually opened up the Hope That Helps podcast on a couple of the MacBooks.
Yes.
So,
hooray!
I'm sure Apple if anyone Store. Wanted to listen to that, well, it's on their platform. It's on their podcast app. So,
hooray!
Figured I'd have some fun with it, you know.
Hope this helps. So, really, head over to Twitter, ask us questions, post your ideas, answer our question.
We'll answer your questions. You answer our questions. Smash that like button. Hit that subscribe button. Most importantly, we could use some reviews on iTunes. Honestly, any kind of review would be fine at this point. Just something.
Say anything. Please. You suck. You rock. We don't care. Just tell us something. We'll take it.
Feedback is appreciated. We're kind of just winging it as we always do. It was just kind of a podcast we wanted to just start doing, so we're not holding ourselves to much of a standard. We're just kind of just doing it, and at this point, I'm just amazed we've gotten to as many episodes as we have and continue to do them. So
I think we just like talking.
I just like talking.
I also just like talking.
Talking so is always really fine. Well.
So again, head over to Hope This Helps, the podcast. Give us some comments. Give us some love. You know, give us some hate. We'll take it. We have thick shells. We work in IT. People tell us we suck all the time.
Yep.
Except for Steve. People really like Steve.
People dislike me for some reason.
He's the charming one.
I guess so. I don't know what I do, but apparently I just, yeah.
He's just the smiles and waves guy.
It happens. I won't question it. I won't count my chickens before they go down in Office 365. I'll just, you know.
You won't put the egg back in the chicken?
I won't put the egg back in the chicken.
All right. Well, from here, from us to you, we hope this helps.
Hope this helps. Don't put the egg back in the chicken.